welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is the legendary Nashville engineer, Ed C. And we're here today with a new computer, a new interface, and kind of the same signal path. But anyway, let me know if it sounds any different, better or worse, or the same. I'd like to know. Can't always trust my own ears on these things, so the more input I have, the better. Anyway, let's start today with the album, because it looks like it's going away. CD sales last year were down from about 235 million the year before to 227 million, and that's still a lot of albums, and those are CDs we're talking about, and these are only the ones that we could measure, because a lot of times CDs are sold at gigs, they're sold off of websites, and those aren't measured at all by SoundScan. So this is probably higher, but nonetheless, album sales are declining. And that's not only CD sales, that's digital as well. So the total album sales were down 316 million to 289 million. This year already, album sales are down 14% from last year. So it's becoming a singles world more and more. It's a streaming world. The only exception to that is vinyl. And vinyl keeps on rising, and believe me, it's never going to come back to where it was, and it's never going to take over from CDs or streaming or anything else. But it is interesting because it's not just older people, classic people that are listening anymore. It's millennials. It's a young demographic. And everybody who's exposed to vinyl really digs it. There's a couple of interesting dynamics that are happening here. And the first is, of course, the sound. And we can debate that one way or the other, but people generally like the sound. It's analog. It feels good. And if you get by the clicks and pops, which you don't have when you first have a brand new piece of virgin vinyl, it really does sound good. Now, that being said, it's not just the sound. I contend there's more to a vinyl album than just that. One of the things is just because of the physics of the disc, it has to be made in a consumable amount of time. So in other words, you only get 22 to 25 minutes per side on an album, and that's very, very consumable. That's something that you can sit down and listen to all the way through. And when you think that you only have about 45 minutes across the whole album, once again, that's fairly consumable. That's not bad at all. When you look at most CDs, you're looking at 50 plus minutes. And it just seems like because we can actually use all of that time, we do, because it's available. One of the things that we don't have on a vinyl album is all that extra time. It's a finite amount of time, and it's something that actually works to the advantage of not only the artist, but it really works to the advantage of the listener as well, because when you sit down, you know it's only going to be that short period of time you can commit to that without thinking too hard about it. And the best part about it is it gives the listener a chance to listen to not only the feel of the album, to try to figure out what the artist is trying to say, but to also listen to songs that they might not have listened to all that much otherwise. When you have a digital album or a CD, because of the random access, you can go from song to song very quickly, and if it doesn't catch your ear in the first few seconds, you can just skip to something else, and that's not quite as easy to do. Well, it's not easy to do at all. When you get a vinyl album, you're kind of forced to listen, and because of that, you can discover something that you might have missed otherwise. And that's a real big part of a vinyl album. The other big part, of course, is the liner notes, which we all love. Well-done liner notes are a thing of beauty. And, of course, you still have a little bit of that in the CD world, but it's not the same. And certainly you don't have that in the digital world. So those are the things that are kind of missing. And, again, albums aren't coming back. Albums are, they're always going to be around. People are always going to do them. But you're going to see the interest wane considerably until there's another reason to buy an album. It's either another trend, it's another format. I don't see it on the horizon right yet, but things do change. Technology changes, and the music business changes right with technology, so you never know what's right around the corner. The other thing I want to talk about today are different tuning standards. Does it affect your health? Can it affect your health? One of the things that most people don't know is the fact that the A440 standard that we all know and love, or maybe we don't love, but we all know for sure, that was only standardized in the U.S. in 1940. It's not that old. And across the entire world, it was standardized in 1953. Now, there's a researcher, music researcher, Dr. Leonard Horowitz, and he claims that the A440 standard was actually a conspiracy between the Rockefeller Foundation and the Nazis. Propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels, for the Nazis, really pushed hard for the 440, A440. The reason why was they determined it provided greater aggression and emotional agitation. And, of course, that benefited what the Nazis were trying to do. Now, again, there's no definitive proof about this. This is a theory that Leonard Horowitz has. But there is something to it, because prior to 1940, there were different tunings. And one that was used a lot was A432, which is sometimes called the Verdi A. Everyone seems to like this a lot when they use it, because it seems to be a more natural vibration. The Egyptians and the Greeks actually used it. It just seems to fit better in nature. 432 fits better with everything that happens. This is the theory. Now, if you listen side by side, you might fool yourself into thinking one is better than the other. And I think the only way that you can know for sure is to do some extensive experiments and really live with both of them for a while. If you want, you can actually go on my blog, my Big Picture blog, and you can hear some differences. And I will post that link so you can go. And this was posted quite a while ago, but you can go and you can hear some differences. It's kind of interesting. There's another tuning standard, and this is called raw natural tuning, RA, raw natural tuning. And this is built around 424 hertz, in other words, A424. This, again, is supposed to be much more in tune with nature, and it was used by the Mayans, and it's supposed to make you feel better. Once again, if you want a comparison, or if you just want to listen to what it's like, I'll also post a link where you can go and hear that as well. So you'll see that posted below here or somewhere in the blog. We'll get that out. Anyway, it's worth checking out different tuning standards other than A440, because A440 is certainly an artificial standard. There was no good reason for it when you actually look into it, except for the fact that it's standardized around the world. But it could very well have been A442. A442 was used a lot. A444 was used a lot. And, of course, A432. So just check that out and have an open mind to these tunings, because there may be something better out there. If you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com, questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. My guest today is the great Nashville engineer, Ed C. Ed has engineered some of the country music's biggest stars, from Alabama, Martina McBride, Garth Brooks, the Gatlin Brothers, Hank Williams Jr., Dolly Parton, Blake Shelton, Willie Nelson, and really the list goes on and on. He's engineered and mixed hundreds of albums and hundreds of artists, and most of them are the country greats. He's also featured in my Mixing Engineer's Handbook. He's one of the prime interviews in it. And he's also Dave Pensado's mentor, which really says a lot. And he's someone that I quote all the time. As a matter of fact, I have to give him a shout out, because I use something that he mentioned in the interview in the Mixing Engineer's Handbook about the three P's, which is pitch, passion, and pocket. And this is the three P's for a vocalist. In other words, in order to get the best performance from a vocalist, you need the three P's: pitch, passion, and pocket. And I mentioned this in my music producer's handbook as well, and I didn't give him credit, and I feel so terrible about it. I've always felt bad about it, and I want to give him a shout out now, because really that's his idea. And Ed is so good at explaining things, and that's one of the ways he explained that to me. So I want to make sure that he has the credit coming to him that's certainly due. So anyway, I talked to Ed from his studio in Nashville via Skype. So Ed, thank you very much for being with me in the podcast. You're one of my favorite people in the audio business, and I'm pleased and honored that you're here.
Oh, thank you.
So let's go back to the beginning. You were a bass player originally, right?
Originally, I was a trombone player. And then jumped into bass. And the good news about bass is that I picked up a few gigs actually reading bass, because it looks just in the staff just like trombone. It just sounds an octave down. So bass was a good progression, and picked up some guitar. And, you know, the Beatles had an influence on everybody. So
how did you get into engineering? How did that happen?
Well, when I was in college, they didn't obviously have this type of the audio engineering technology programs that a lot of the school have nowadays. So I'd go to the radio studio, and I would want to do something more than just talk into the Wallensack. So what I would do was went to the radio studio on off hours. They had a student radio at University of Georgia, and I'd take the microphone and play guitar into the mic to a mono piece of tape, and then take the mono piece of tape and run it back through the board and add something else, you know, just layered up like that. So I said, well, that's pretty cool. But, you know, like so many of us, we said, well, our band is going to make it to the top. We're going to be great. And so after the frustrations of having gigs fall through and the typical frustrations, and we were a really good band, but we didn't have original material, blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know, if I could ever just get it once right in the studio, I think that's really where I need to be. So I got out of school and knocked on really the first studio door that I knew that was back in Atlanta. There was a handful of studios, and the guy remembered me because I'd interviewed him a year and a half before on a project that we had to write a brochure, and I went to the studio. So I went back to that studio, and he said, you're in luck. The guy just left last Friday. This is Monday, so can you start tomorrow? And I said, yeah. He said, okay, at least 50, 60, 70 hours a week. Okay. You know, minimum wage. Okay. So, you know, I got in and ran with the ball from there.
And what studio was that? Was that one that we'd know?
Well, it was a studio called Master Sound Recording Studio. It was down on Spring Street. They had recorded some of the when I got there to finally started working there, they were working on Lobo. I'd Love You to Want Me and Don't Expect Me to Mean You, No Dog Named Boo, and all those records. Well, a lot of those they had done there at Master Sound, and Master Sound had two rooms, the studio in the back, which was the big music room, and then a production room in the front that had, it's where they did voiceovers and commercials and, you know, cue the announcer and he would come in and read. And today at Sears, the refrigerators are on sale, and at the end, pop the music up and then cut paper leader in between and go to the next one. And so you had to, you know, do your diligence there before you could get to the studio in the back. But once I got to the studio, it was like, okay, even after my shift was over and it was going home time, I'd go to the back and hang around. I couldn't get enough, you know.
Yeah.
So many of us, I know our buddy Dave Pensado, we agree on that. It was like, you can't get enough. You'd stay there around the clock.
Yeah, yeah. I did the same thing too. Yeah, definitely. Was Paul Davis your first hit?
Paul was my first. Yeah, I believe he was. He really hadn't had a top 20 record at that point. Actually not even a top 30. And we started working together and it was a record, I Go Crazy. It started out as a demo. It started out as a demo for Lou Rawls, because around that time that You'll Never Find Boom Boom Ba Ba Boom was big, and so he said, hey, I think this would be a good, I'm tired of trying to be an artist, this would be a good record for Lou Rawls. And so the president of the record company, after I left Master Sound, I went to a place called Web4 Music in Atlanta and Bang Records. It was all under the same umbrella. And the owner of the studio said, you're not giving that to, heard the demo, you're not giving that to Lou Rawls. Get back there and make me a record. So we finished the record up, and And yeah, that was my first hit record that I recorded and mixed and went to number seven. And so it was a great experience. And actually, Paul taught me how to make records.
Well, and how did he learn? From, did he have hits before?
He had records before. They weren't real big hit. The biggest hit before that was a song called Ride 'em Cowboy. And it was like number 37 in the charts, and it made a little splash, but not a huge one. And but he had worked with Chips Moman in the past. Mm-hmm. He had worked with Jeff Berry out of New York in the past, and he was just a very wise fella, and a very country, very slow talking, but very bright. And and he, you know, he didn't teach me engineering. And in fact, back then there wasn't anybody really to teach you engineering. That it was the mentoring process. And back at Master Sound, the guy that had been there 8 months before me basically showed me, well, here's the preamp and here's where it comes back over. And this is the MCI 16 track. And if you slam the drawers, the meters all go haywire. So, you know, that kind of stuff. But when I got to moved over to Web 4 and Bang Records, then started engineering, honing my engineering skills, because it was a private studio, not for public. And so we had a lot of time to try everything, plug everything in at once, or try this and that. And it was a great experience. And so I learned really my engineering more there. But Paul taught me how to make records, taught me the art of that.
And how did you get to Nashville?
In 1984, Atlanta goes through, is different now, but back then it would go through hills and valleys. And Paul would make some records that we were working on. They'd have some success, and then there was a drought. And then another fellow I was working with, Peebo Bryson, great R&B singer. Yeah. He'd have some success, and that would go away. And across town, Atlanta Rhythm Section up in Dorville would have some hits. And so there were like little waves that would come through. Kansas was making some records down there, but it wasn't an industry. And you know, the high times and the low times of Atlanta. And so basically everybody that I knew had moved on, had stopped in Atlanta for a while and moved on to Nashville. And so I looked and I said, well, I got three choices: Nashville, New York, or LA. And I'd worked in LA and I liked it. And I'd also worked in New York and I really liked that a lot. But Nashville was 4 hours away, and it seemed to make sense. And so moved to Nashville and started over there. And so and moved to Nashville in a time when it was, well, it was mid-1984. And there was a real slump in the record business in Nashville. Prior to that, there had been a movie, Urban Cowboy.
Yeah.
And Urban Cowboy had come out, and cowboys and cowboy hats and some country music. And for a brief second, Nashville said, hey, we're cool. Nashville, country's cool. And then the slump happened again. It was like, wait a second, that was just a movie. We're not cool. I mean, it came and went. And so I moved to, when I was in Nashville, starting in about mid-1984, worked on, actually, some of the first work I did was some Christian music, because they, the producer didn't want a country drum sound. Well, coming out of Atlanta, I had really never worked on a country record in Atlanta, because people came up to Nashville to work on country. So I wound up doing those, picking up that client and worked on that. Eventually got into the country, the country scene. And that's really the path that I took. And then along around 1989 or 90, all of a sudden, Nashville was starting to catch on fire. Ricky Skaggs, with his kind of new revival of that great sound, took off, and so many things, so many artists, Travis Tritt and Clint Black, and I was working with Highway 101 at the time, and Desert Rose Band with one of my heroes, Chris, uh, Chris Hillman from the Byrds. So, and I always loved the Byrds. So we're working on that kind of stuff. But about that time, Garth and Shania hit, and then it was like, oh boy, here it comes.
Yeah.
And so for a decade, we had unbelievable times. But that's how I got to Nashville.
So how was Atlanta different from Nashville, or vice versa, in terms of recording? Did you find that there was a big differences in what you knew or what you had to know?
Let's see. I don't think there were big differences. The main differences I found was that Atlanta at the time didn't really have any record companies, and Nashville, of course, did. And the record companies have always been the banks. I mean, they pay for the sessions, the players, the cartage, the studios, the catering, the whatever. So that was a main difference. As far as my engineering, I think I didn't grow up with the same set of rules, because I was making pop records and R&B records. And I moved up, and the thing I noticed really was that the engineering, although there were great engineers, it was a fairly polite medium. Everybody was very careful and add a little reverb, but not too much reverb, and just a touch. And that's nothing radical, everything kind of pleasant. And one of the things I came out of Atlanta knowing and doing the records I was doing was room mics. I certainly didn't invent room mics, but we would use that to get a sound. That was part of the drum sound. So I moved up here, and everything was so tight mic'd and close and polite. And on Highway 101, one of the first breakout projects up here was that I'd worked on, put up the room mics in a real explosive live room, and the toms sounded like cannons, and it got everybody's attention, because everybody was zigging and here we were zagging, you know. So that really helped. But the main big difference is Nashville had so many fabulous session players. Now, Atlanta had some great players, no question about it. Some were rock specialists. One guy was a jazz guy, and there wasn't any depth in the chairs like there is in Nashville, because there's so many great guitar players and so many bass players and keyboard players, and everybody just has fabulous sounding instruments, and there's cartage companies to bring them in and set them up. And it's just, it makes you look real good when you're recording a fabulous player with great gear. And so that was a big difference there.
When you talk about room mics, is there anything special that you do to them? And in terms of, is there a placement? Were you looking for something in particular? You're listening for something? Are you processing them in a particular way?
Well, there is. Back then, what I was mainly doing was trying to just get a bigger sound. I mean, when I moved up here, "Oh Sherry" by Journey was on the air, and that was such a big, explosive sound, because they were an arena rock act, so they needed to sound big and powerful. And so what I would do is I would back the mics back. I was in front, you know, looking at the kit, and I'd back the mics way back to catch a little of the live drums, but also the room. And then at other times I would go behind the drums, because there was a big wooden wall, big 30-foot ceiling, and I'd actually look at the corners of the wall there, because the sound, by the time it hit the wall and then came back off, was more diffused and had a different sound. So I was looking for bigness and explosiveness. These days, more often than not, what I'm liking is a bloom line technique in front of the drums with two ribbon mics, and like at 45 degrees. And the beauty of that is you can actually work it fairly close to the kit, and you get some presence and some vibe there. But since ribbons are hot in the back, figure eight, it also picks up the back of the room and throws some compression on that. And it's a great technique for making a medium-sized room sound big, or a small room sound bigger, you know, than it really is. So that's what I do more often than not.
What's the difference these days in the Nashville of today than when you first moved?
One thing is the style of music. There was country music when I moved up here. Now, country music has gotten extremely aggressive. It sounds really more like rock.
Yeah.
And it just has progressed and grown. It's gearing for a younger audience. One of the terms that's being bantered around is bro country. And there's a lot of it on the air, and it's hard hitting, big drums, big bass, a lot of loops. There were no loops when I moved up. Nobody used loops. Now, in the Christian market, they did. Actually, they did some programming in loops and stuff, but not in country. And when I moved up, there were no Syndrums and that, or Simmons or any of that kind of stuff. That there wasn't, and then there became, everybody was using that, and now we're back to organic drums now, but with a lot of programming again, and sampling, and the compression has become massive on a lot of the records, to the point where it's just sometimes the lineage, how this takes place, it seems to me, is the publishing companies need to get attention. Their songs need to get some attention to get the artist or the producer or the record company or the manager, whoever, to hear this song and say, wow, that sounds like a hit. And so there's so much compression on the demos that you take it into the studio, the artist or the producer says, hey, I love this song, let's take it to the studio. So the producer says, okay, here's the song we're going to cut, and you put it on, and it's already slammed to the wall. And so if you do something less than that, it's like, well, we didn't quite hook the demo. The demo's beating us, you know? So then you have to lean on it harder and harder. When they mix the demo, mix the record, it has to be blowing up. And then when it gets to the mastering, one of my mastering buddies said that, you know, he'll have to turn the record down a half a dB to add anything, because it's all at the top, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's just that's a big difference. Actually, all of this kind of started with the SSL, I guess the 4000, because they had that quad compressor in the center of the board. So I could do a great mix and you could do a great mix, and if the mixes sound the same, but you hit that compressor and popped it up just a little bit, it would be like, well, I like Bobby's mix, you know?
Yeah.
And so then if a little is good, a lot's better, and 10 times as much, it must be great. So that's a huge change right there.
You know what I find interesting? If you look at the demographics of music, well, if you just look at what music is selling, and it looks like rock music is really off as compared to country and as compared to, you know, R&B and whatever. But then if you think about it, it's like, well, wait a second. Country is really rock. It's 70s, 80s rock. So maybe rock isn't as dead as everybody thinks. It's just morphed a little bit.
Yeah,
you know,
it seems like it. It seems so. I think so. Basically, folks like to rock. It's fun to rock, you know.
Yeah.
And the music has geared younger and younger and younger. And now I say that, but it's funny. Not so much here in Nashville. This isn't a regional thing, but my son is 19, and he likes Radiohead and bands that have lots of texture, a lot of Euro texture and layers and vibe, very vibey. And so slam and rock is not, I mean, he likes it okay, but he doesn't gravitate that way. Where my other son, you know, he's now liking the modern country stuff, but before that it was extreme metal. So I think there's a wide variety out there for everybody.
You were a mentor to Dave Pensado, our mutual friend, and he, every time I talk to him, he mentions you and he credits you for his success. He's very thankful and he's very appreciative, yeah, as Dave is. Yeah. And you also had Brendan O'Brien, right, as an assistant? Is that true?
Well, not exactly. But the way that worked was when I left Atlanta, I had an assistant. And when I left Atlanta, my assistant took over the job, and my assistant got Brendan to assist. Brendan was looking for a job, so I was already out of the scene. I know Brendan, and I run into him every now and then. But so he took the assistant job down there. And the thing about Brendan, he's such a great musician in terms of rhythm section. I mean, plays drums, he plays guitar, and I don't mean just plays, he plays really good guitar and good bass, and he understands that rhythm section thing, and it certainly reflects in his Black Crows and all the records, the giant list of records he's done. And so he was there for a while, and then he moved on, and he actually, I gave him some advice. He reminds me of some advice I gave him. He said, "Well, Ed, I'm thinking about," I think he had come up here, I believe, and was looking around. It must have been mid-90s. And he said, "I'm thinking about coming to Nashville. You think I ought to get into country?" And I remember I saying, "Man, you're a rocker. You need to rock. I mean, that's what you need to do. You probably need to go to L.A., you know?"
Yeah.
And because I could see that's where he can do it all, but that was where he was, that was his comfort zone right then. And he was making such great sounds. And so he thanks me every time for making that direction change there.
Well, you know, I'm curious because when you explain something about audio, you have a way of doing it that's really explicit and to the point, but it's very easy to grasp. And of course, I always look at the interviews you've done for the Mixing Engineer's Handbook as one. But when we talk, you always talk about something as well, and it's the same thing. It's like, wow, I never looked at it like that or thought of it like that. When you have an assistant, do you do the same thing to him? Is it more of the mentorship of watching, or are you actually kind of in teaching mode as you're doing it?
Well, if it's one-on-one, and he's watching me do work, what I'll wind up doing is, and what I have done in the past, is wind up talking basically to myself and giving a dialogue, like saying, "All right, well, I've got to EQ this thing. And so let's see, sounds a little dull to me, so I better reach up here. But at the same time, maybe we ought to get the mic a little closer." And, you know, I'll give a running dialogue that most people would just keep in their head and just do it, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think that helps. It helps, you know, them to kind of see where I'm going with it and why I'm doing it. Not just what I'm doing, but why I'm doing it. That's the real key to the thought process to me. Not just give me the answer, but how did you get that answer? You know.
Well, yeah, you're so good at that, actually, because you always explain as, you know, part of the dialogue is why you're doing something. I don't even know if you realize you do that, but you do it so well, and it's just part of your dialogue. It's great.
Thanks so much.
Do you, when you're recording, are you, and you have different genres, perhaps, and you know, we talked about doing R&B before and then to country, and then you went to some Christian music through all that. Do you approach tracking differently, depending on the genre?
Well, to some extent, I guess I do. What I wind up doing now is, here's the thing. If you're recording drums, let's say if you're tracking and doing drums, and the real evolution, I guess, is how many tracks we are now afforded. When, like on the record I Go Crazy we were talking about, it was a 16-track record, and we didn't have automation. So it was, you know, the last thing that went on the record were drums. And we had a Korg Rhythm Ace, one of those. You know. Precursor to the drum machine. And so it was like, well, we need some drums on this thing. And Paul said, I know a drummer, flew the drummer in, and we had three tracks left. So I put kick on one track, snare with some hi-hat on another track, and then everything else on the third track. I mean, that's all there were, was. And but now, so used to be when you track drums, you have four tracks of drums. Or then five. And then we were in the middle of a disco era back there years ago. And so the hat became as important as anything else. Psst, psst, psst. That had to have a track. So now we're up to five. Well, then when you got to 24 track, well, now we can have our overheads separate from our toms, or we can have more toms. And so that's great. And then up here, 32 track digital on tape kicked in. And so then we had many more tracks. And so I think where I'm going with this is today, if I'm recording some drums and everybody is in the mindset of options, that no one, and I'm not shaking the finger at anybody. We all have so many colors on the palette, and no one, it's harder for people to make a decision these days. It's like, well, put three solos on there, we'll figure it out later. Yeah. And part of that is everybody's having to move so much faster now because the budgets are smaller and time is so short. But one of the things is, if I'm recording drums, I don't always know if they're going to want a tight drum sound, or an explosive big roomy drum sound, or this kind of thing. So I'll try to do all of the above, and the reason is, even if they say, oh no, we'll never need the room mics, as soon as you do it, it's, boy, I wish where'd those room mics go? Well, you said you didn't. So what I wind up doing is I'll record the room mics, and if the music is not going that way, if it's a R&B thing, of course move the room mics in tighter. If it's a real live room, don't use Bloomline. You don't need a liver room. You need a tighter sound. Some people say, well, why are you miking every drum? Why are you every tom and every hat? Well, if you don't want to hear that sound, you can just turn up the room mics and the overheads and the kick and snare, and you're okay. You're there. But if somebody said, I wish we could mix tom two louder or add some bottom, well, we can, because it's on a separate track. So I try to be versatile in that regard. With guitar mics, I like to mic with two. I like a dynamic and a condenser, or a dynamic and a ribbon for a little smoother sound. Now, you don't always need two. I didn't always used to use two mics on the guitar. But part of the reason I'm using two mics now is several reasons. One is you get a different, one mic hears it one way and another mic hears it another, or you can mic different speakers, or you can pull one back and have a kind of a roomier sound, which is great for slide guitar or something that, I mean, everything up close is kind of narrow-minded, you know, because when you walk into a room and you hear a band playing, you're not hearing everything right up to the, you know, on your, with your ear to the cabinet and the snare. And so I'll use the two mics. But another reason, other than color differences and being able to pan things in an interesting way, is what I call butt coverage. And this really kicked in one time. I was tracking something. We'd set up the night before, everything went great. We had a 3-hour recording session, and The guitar player rolled in. He's giving me a sound. Sounds great. Both mics, everything great. So about 3 minutes before downbeat, and we had already kind of all of a sudden one of the mics is not working. The 87. I had an 87 and a 57 on the guitar cabinet. One mic's not working. I said, okay, well, let's change the mic. So we changed it. Still did. Well, let's change the cord. Still did. So I said, let's change everything. Let's change the preamp. Let's change the cable. Let's change everything. Still wasn't working. And I said, sorry, guys, we got to go. We got to start this because we're it's going to cost us another song. So I said, and by the way, we've got a second mic on there. It sounds great. Let's go. You know, so butt coverage. I covered my butt.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. You were one of the first people to get into mixing in the box. And you're not afraid of technology. And that's one of the things I really love about you is the fact that you embrace it. You embrace anything that's new if it's going to help you or if you think that it's going to help the mix. Where are you at with mixing in the box now? I know that I've been to your studio, and you seem incredibly comfortable with it. Do you ever look back and say, oh, I wish I had a console for this?
Very rarely. It's still fun to mix on a console, but I always feel that I'll get to a certain place, and it's like, I wish I could do this. It's easy to do this in the box, and I can do something else, and it'll be okay, and it'll be good. And of course, then there's the hybrid of using both. But the truth is that we live in such a recall world right now. First of all, I love mixing in the box. I was fortunate that I guessed right. You know, I saw it coming, and me and my partner said, you know, we've been flirting with Pro Tools because we needed to edit some drums or edit a take or do some manipulations, tune a vocal or whatever we needed to do back in the early days. And after we figured, well, we're never going to learn this system. We're going to have to keep hiring people to do this unless we just buy a system. So we bought a system, and after working with it a little bit, we said, you know, I think we can mix in this thing. And he said, yeah, I think we can too. So we started doing that. And what you mentioned was even though people had mixed in the box on some rap music and some pop music, but I was the first to mix a number one record in the country market. And a song called Austin by Blake Shelton. The world we live in now is, and that's this fast forward up to 2014. The world we live in now is everybody wants to, two things are different. It used to be when you'd mix a record, must be present to win. Everybody had to be there. The artist was there. The producer was there. You were there as an engineer. The assistant was there. The manager might have been there. If the record company guy had something to say or wanted to be there, he had to be there. Now, nobody's there. You mix the record, and it's like, well, I'm in Omaha. Send me an MP3. And the other guy said, well, just drop a CD off at the desk, although they're going away. And so nobody's there. And you send it, and then people are used to listening to it and saying, you know, love the record. Can you extend the fade or turn off the harmony on the first chorus or recall touch-up stuff? Okay, so the first time I had to do that on a big board, it took me almost a half a day, or actually a three quarters of a day to reset the board. It wasn't even an automated board. It was a Trident 80B.
Ooh.
And it was hard to repatch everything. And then you're stuck with this, okay, what do I do with this bill? I mean, they're going to, you know, laugh me out of town if I turn in a giant bill again and again for all the changes. I saw that coming. So the next step was an SSL with a Total Recall, but then it became Pro Tools with Instant Recall and call it up in 45 seconds, make the change, reburn the thing. They listen to it and they say, great, or come back in next week or next month, have some more changes. So that's the world we live in. And, And because of that, it's almost a necessity these days. Plus, the colors on the palette are so, there are so many different colors on the palette. So that you just, one of the reasons I wanted to get into Pro Tools was I was hearing sounds and techniques and devices and things that I didn't have in my toolbox that I was hearing on the radio, especially pop records. And even simple stuff like Pro Tools Verify, where at the end of something, and it was like, wow, how did they do that? I mean, yeah, you could do it the old way, but that would be hard. You'd have to have a tape machine there and da-da-da. So I wanted those sounds, you know, and so all of a sudden now there are so many sounds. At one time I had basically all the plugs. Nobody can have all the plugs anymore. Yeah. It's impossible. There's too many. But there's so many great colors and great sounds. And so I love that feature. And I'll never forget when I first, it must have been about 1992 or 91, somebody was saying, well, Ed, what have you been doing? I said, well, I've been mixing this record in the box. And the guy went, one of my buddies up here, famous engineer, he said, oh, man, like I was a traitor, like I had, you know.
Yeah.
So, well, then flash forward about 10 years, and then he said, yeah, you know, I've been mixing in the box and having really good. I said, yeah, okay, there you go.
Yeah. Do you use a summing amp?
No, I don't. I have tried that. I haven't felt that it's honestly, necessary. I've done some really good comparisons. I've actually taken the whole mix and piped it back into several different consoles and said, okay, well, let's try this as a summing amp. I've tried it on SSL, Neve, Trident. You would get the sound that you would expect from each different console, but I don't find that that's absolutely necessary. Some people swear by it, but I've noticed a lot of the summing boxes that they use are more than just summing boxes. There's EQ there. There's the width knob, and so if you add a bunch of different color to the mix with width and EQ, and say, well, listen, it sounds better. Well, it sounds way different too. I mean, yeah. If you wanted it wider, we can do that. The reason that I like mixing in the box these days, not only is it, the mix sounds to me exactly like what I had, rather than even transferring to tape.
Yeah.
Which the tape has a cool sound, but the tape has the low end bump, the head bump around 90 or 100 or wherever that bump is, and a little bit of tape compression. And it used to be you transfer to tape and you'd say, coming out of the no compression, no EQ the mix school, and it was like, yeah, it's better. A little more bottom, a little tighter pack. This is good, you know.
Yeah.
Well, now, compression, there's so much compression on the mixes that's negligible that what you get with a tape. I don't use I don't use a summing box, although I try them every now and then, but I wind up coming back to where we are now.
Last question for you. What's the best piece of business advice that you've either received from someone or you've learned through the years?
I think try not to be, it's okay to have your pet style of music. If you're a country guy and only want to do country records, that's fine. Or if you're a hip hop guy or a rap guy, that's fine. But I think to be versatile, it's good to be able to get to do a really great job on any style of music as a mixer, as an engineer, and not to snob somebody else's music. Because right now there's such a variety that comes through the door. I'm working on actually mixing some Southern gospel right now. I haven't worked on that in a long time. White Southern gospel.
Wow.
Before that, it was it wasn't exactly bro country, but it was some aggressive country music. And then before that, it was some Italian some music of yesteryear, like Dean Martin kind of stuff that he would sing, and some Tom Jones. And so it's, in addition to the normal, and maybe some bluegrass thrown in, it's just a big variety, and it's fun. The variety is great, and embrace it rather than say, oh, I just wanted to do rock, you know, or I just wanted to do whatever, because that's part of the advice. And the other advice is, you know, when you start out, and I truly believe this, when you start out originally as an engineer, I can say I did. I sucked. I mean, I didn't really know too much about it. And then I got better. Okay. And then I said, okay, well, look, I'm going to use everything at my disposal and twist every knob and go through every compressor and every EQ. And then I started to suck again because it just sounded really weird. And then I broke through the clouds and got better again and kind of learned from that experience. And then I got really good. And the next step, I mean, from that is really, I mean, when you think about it, a snare can only get so good and a kick drum can only get so good and a vocal can only get so good. So the next step is be consistent. And I want to knock a triple or a home run every time at bat. I never want to strike out. I never want to just bunt and get on first, you know? And so to be consistent, the worst thing is like, oh yeah, he's great some days and other days, not so good, you know, yeah. That's the worst. So I think the advice is, try really hard to be consistent as well.
Very cool. Thank you so much for being with me, Ed. This was great. As always, lots of fun.
Thanks a lot.
If you want to find out more about Ed, you can go to edsey.com. That's E-D-Ed, S-E-A-Y, E-D-S-E-A-Y.com. You'll find out a lot more about Ed. You might want to go look at his discography, which is really extensive. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send questions at BobbyOInnerCircle.com, questions at BobbyOInnerCircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who's the host of the Producer Podcast at theproducer.club, C-U-L-V, and he helps put this podcast together. He does a great job. Thank you, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or you can go directly to BobbyOInnerCircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At BobbyOsinski.com, you'll also find the sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts to new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski, and I'll see you next time.